Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Brooklyn Ball Factory, a Japanese eatery and coffee shop at 95 Montrose Avenue in East Williamsburg. Learn more at brooklynballfactory.com.
HRN is offering complimentary business memberships to 50 Black, Indigenous, people of color-owned food businesses this summer. The deadline to apply is July 31st. Each business membership, a $500 value, is an advertising opportunity that will allow businesses disproportionately impacted by COVID-19 to connect with HRN's listening community and promote their work. To apply and review the terms and conditions, go to heritageradionetwork.org/BIZ.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. I hope everyone is safe and well, and we normally broadcast live from our studio at the Reuters in Bushwick, Brooklyn, but our studio is currently closed due to the coronavirus outbreak, so we are recording this episode remotely and in my apartment in Williams, Brooklyn, and my guest, Sakura. I assume she's from, well, we'll tell you later. So this show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deal in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guest. And my guest today is Sakura Yagi, who is the Chief Operating Officer at the TIC Group. And the TIC Group is very important for the Japanese food culture in New York City. It is founded by Sakura's father, Bon Yagi, who is regarded as the founder of the Japantown in East Village. In 1984, Mr. Yagi opened his first restaurant, Hasaki, in East Village. This great sushi restaurant is still there and remains very popular. And actually, that's definitely one of my favorite restaurants in New York City. Mm-hmm. And after Hasaki... Mr. Yagi opened many more approachable and high-quality restaurants, and the TIC Group is now operates 13 restaurants in Manhattan. And if you're interested in Mr. Yagi's intriguing life and inspiration, you can listen to episode 14. And Sakura joined his father 8 years ago and has been working hard to keep the company authentic as well as fresh and modern. So today we'll discuss why Sakura decided to work for his father's company, challenges she faces in managing the diverse collection of Japanese restaurants, what is happening in the Japanese food culture in New York City right now, and much, much more. But before you start, Japan Eats is available on the Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. So now let's start our conversation with Sakura Yagi. Hello, Sakura. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
So this is exciting. We had your father, Mr. Bon Yagi, on episode 14, as I said, back in 2015. And he's truly a forward thinker and a great leader of the community. He's built over, I think, 36 years here in New York. And he gets so tremendously about the younger generations and his community and actively supporting them, whether by providing opportunity as an employer or by generously donating money. So I really respect your father.
Thank you so much. He definitely says that community is one of the most important things, and community is what helps not just his business, but also life in general. And having a kid of my own, I definitely understand what he's talking about. And I was raised to put importance on community. And that's something that I want to pass on as well.
Wow. Okay. So you are from New York, of course, and then grew up in a great environment where you had access to any high quality Japanese food that you'd like. So what did you eat when you grew up?
Well, I spend most of my dinners at home, actually. I still think my mother's home cooking, traditional Japanese home meals, is the best thing ever. And so, like any other kid, I think I grew up really enjoying my mother's cooking, and that's where my main frame of reference is rooted. In terms of Japanese food, the flavor profiles that Japanese food is and should be actually come from my mother's cooking. And we operate a bunch of restaurants. And of course, I grew up going to the restaurants and eating out a lot. But I would say the majority of the things that I ate was due to my mother's cooking, and I actually didn't ever have like takeout until I actually went to college. So my mother cooked all of our meals, and or we would go out to eat. So I was very privileged with that.
Right, you are. Right. And I was very impressed that the first time I think exchanged an email about your father's show. And I was impressed. Your writing in Japanese is also perfect too. That really indicates that you have very real understanding Japanese culture, despite the fact that you're born and raised here. So that's very interesting to me.
Oh, thank you. My mother really wanted us to not be held back by our language ability, and so she really made it her mission to try to teach us and encourage us to learn Japanese, not just language-wise, but culturally. And I still find it difficult to write emails in Japanese. It requires much more effort than an English email. And there are times when I mess up a lot, but I think at least trying or attempting to is important. So I'm very appreciative of my, again, mother for training me to do that, to speak right. Japanese and to study it.
Right. Awesome. She did an amazing job. So and then when you grew up, how did you feel about your father running many successful Japanese restaurants and building a kind of important community? Did you want to be a part of it one day?
I think I was already a part of the company. I grew up in the company. I would say that the restaurants are almost like siblings to me. I don't think I was the firstborn child, even though human-wise I am. I would say that you mentioned Hasaki in 84. I would say that is probably his firstborn child, in the sense of, you know, he created this restaurant that he poured his heart and sweat, blood and tears into. And it's very similar to raising a child in a way, you know, building a restaurant and constantly looking after it and making sure that it's okay. And, you know, I think, so I grew up with a lot of restaurants that seemed to me like siblings, and the staff that operate the restaurants are very much kind of extended family, I would say. Some staff have worked for our restaurants for 20 years. And so they've known me for that long. And so it is kind of like a big family or a community. And it's not something that, you know, in terms of my career, and I'm sure we'll get into this, but you know, I always saw myself as part of the company, whether that was by choice or by like osmosis. But I grew up in it. So, it was just part of me.
Right. I'm sure you were the easiest one among all those siblings. So, so then you worked in research, media, and public relations before you joined the TIC Group in 2012. So why did you decide to work for your father's company?
I graduated college right around the time of financial turmoil, you know, when the Lehman Brothers, you know, the Lehman shock and everything. So it was really difficult to find a job, but I was determined to kind of go off on my own and do my own thing. But I stayed in New York and I did a lot of odd jobs and then ended up in PR. But in 2012, my father actually was diagnosed with prostate cancer. And so when that happened, I thought to myself, what's going to happen with the company? He didn't have a succession plan. And so I thought, hey, you know, if I'm slaving away at work, putting countless of hours into a company, why not do it for my family, do it for a company that my father worked very hard to build. And so I told him and my mother that I planned to join the company to try to help him develop a plan of action for the next phase of, or the next decade. I got actually a lot of pushback from my parents saying that they did not want me to join the company, primarily because they wanted me to do something that they were not able to do as first generation immigrants. I was the first person out of my immediate family to go to college. Both of my parents didn't go to college. And so, you know, they had more white collar aspirations for me, to put it in a nice way. They wanted me to be the typical, you know, doctor or lawyer or something along those lines. But I figured that this joining the company was the best thing that I could do. And it was the job that possibly I was the only one who could do. That was the thought that came into my mind. And that's why I joined the company without my parents' blessing.
Wow. That's interesting. But why do you think you are the right person?
I think I was the right person only because I think that in order to assist my father in upgrading the systems and making changes that were necessary, he needed someone who understood the core of his business, but also was willing to be the no person, to be the person to kind of twist his arm into doing things that maybe he didn't want to do. And that was something that I became the person to do, whether it was upgrading our point of sale system or getting him to do email, have an email address, you know, things that maybe required more teeth pulling or, you know, just things that didn't really seem necessary to him. I thought that I could convince him to adopt because I was in the unique position of being a family member, his daughter, and could kind of propel him into the next phase of his company.
Right. And of course, you totally understand everything about each restaurant's culture and who's working and mentality of it. So, yeah, that's great. So tell us about the TIC Group. So what is the corporate philosophy and what restaurants do you have?
So the corporate philosophy is authentic Japanese food. Our motto is enjoy Japan without airfare. And so we try to create each restaurant, not just in the food, but the atmosphere and the feeling, to be as if you were transported to Japan. And as you generously mentioned, we have several restaurants in Manhattan, some of them including Sakagura, Decibel, High Collar, Shabutatsu, Rai Rai Ken, Korea, Sobaya, Odafuku, Cha'an, Hasaki. I'm like, did I mention them all? I'm sure I'm forgetting some of them, but they're all different concepts. And they all try to transport you with the food and or atmosphere. And that's our mission. And right. My father really emphasizes the feeling, not just you go in for a meal and it tastes like what you would have in Japan. It's more about, you know, everything else besides that, whether that's, you know, where the noren is or how the chopsticks are laid out or, you know, just the vibe of the place. And it's not just the structure, but it's also the staff and how the customers feel. So it's a very new thing, but that's something that he really cares about.
Right. Yeah, I sometimes imagine, what if I just go to, you know, Hasaki or Sakagura, whatever, I feel like the moment I was in Japan, when I leave the restaurant, like, wow, this is New York City. So, yeah, it's amazing how long that kind of motto has imbibed, like, so strongly, and you guys are doing amazing. Yeah. So, or the TIC Group's restaurant concepts are, like you said, authentic, but you grew up in New York, and how did you learn the authentic Japanese food culture? Did you go to Japan often, or of course, your mother must be really important too.
Yes, but I do think that going to Japan, I would go to Japan at least twice a year when I was younger. I would spend my summers in Japan. So once school was over here, was done in New York, my mother and I and my brother, we would go to Japan, stay at my grandmother's place, and we would actually go to Japanese public school for a month or so because schools in Japan don't break for summer until, you know, end of July. So here in New York, it would be over in end of May or early June. So you had almost 2 months or so to go to school in Japan. And so my mother would send me to the elementary school that she went to in Japan. And I would have to go to school for those extra months.
Wow.
And so to get that, and you know, at that time, I was very, very resentful of the fact that I had to continue going to school. But, you know, looking back, I'm really grateful because I have a lot of memories that only Japanese people who went to school in Japan have, like, you know, things like Morning Glory Diary, like Asagao Nikki, like things like that. You know, like if I didn't go to school in Japan for those months, I would have never had the experience or the you know, the privilege to know what it feels like to go to school in Japan. So I feel very lucky to have experienced that. And in that same breath, you know, to just kind of live like Japanese people do in Japan, whether that's, you know, I don't know if this is a good example, but for example, in Japan, We were in Tokyo. We were in Saitama, which is like Connecticut in comparison to the States. Like New York is Tokyo, outside them was kind of like Connecticut. But so we would cut, we were in the suburbs, but my idea of like ramen takeout or like demae is like this young guy on a moped who would have like a silver box on the back of his moped, and you would have ceramic bowls, ramen bowls, that would have your ramen piping hot in it, and it would have tons of saran wrap wrapped around it. And after you have your bowl of ramen that they would deliver to your house, you would wash the ceramic bowl and put it outside your house so that the ramen shop, the local ramen shop, could come around and pick up the bowls, the ceramic bowls, to bring it back to the store. I mean, that is my concept of takeout ramen. And I think having that kind of reference point of what takeout ramen is kind of has shaped what, you know, we want our ramen to be like, and kind of try to strive for that. Not that we are able to do that in New York City, but to know that that's what we're aiming for, or that's what, you know, it should be, is an interesting.
Right. Interesting. So, yeah, it's like the community feeling. Right? You kind of, you're responsible. You ate, you wash your thing. And I mean, here in New York City, if you left the bowl, probably it's going to be stolen. But so, especially yeah. Screen one. Yeah. But yeah, that's interesting. And so, probably you experienced the school lunches in Japan too, right? While you were.
Yeah.
Right. So, that's kind of like you are. You have a very different idea of what food is like, in, is the part of your life and responsibility too. So
I definitely think so. Yes. I think right. my parents instilled in me they've always said that food is kind of the window to the culture. And so, you know, I was very, very privileged. My parents, my father especially loved to travel. And so we would go to different places all around the world, and we would really just dive into the food and, you know, not just the places. I mean, this was pre like, you know, guidebooks or Google, but, you know, just the local shop and talk to the locals and see what they were eating and talk to them about it and just kind of dive into the food culture that way. Kind of like Anthony Bourdain style. And I think that's definitely, you know, we want to provide that for New Yorkers. And I think we have, in the sense that you're exposed to the Japanese food through our restaurants. And then you go to Japan and, you know, even if it's ramen, for example, or soba, you try it here. And then you're like, wow, like, I really want to go to Japan and like try the different types of takoyaki, or, you know, just have what Japanese kare is like, or, you know, go have real shabu shabu or yakiniku in Japan, like to kind of whet that appetite, literally, for people in New York, and then, and for people coming back from Japan, you know, people who take a trip to Japan and they loved going to Osaka and eating takoyaki, and they look for a place that serves it, and that's what we provide, kind of like, oh, you're missing your Japan trip? Well, come have a taste at our place. And we have a lot of customers because they went to Japan and they wanted to, you know, they were koishi. They were like, they missed the food that they had in Japan. So
right.
It's very interesting, yeah.
Right. And it's really pleasing to find actual authentic food back in New York. So I really appreciate your place. So as the CEO of the company, what's your mission?
My mission has always been the same from the beginning, which is to make the restaurant or the group or the business sustainable for the long run. I think creating a company that has a solid infrastructure that can last beyond my own generation. That's been my goal. Will the company operate without me? Will the company survive me? And that's kind of what I have prioritized from the beginning and continue to prioritize. And they say that in the family business, the second and third generation is the most critical. The farther you get away from the founding entrepreneurial spirit, the less successful it can be. And so, I wanted to make sure that me joining the company meant that the company had a future. And that's kind of why I joined. And that's been my mission.
Right.
To give tangible examples, I've really used technology to try to make the company more efficient and to make systems that required less human errors and could be more efficient in terms of time and the amount of hours that people needed to work. I my father is probably the hardest working person that I know. My friends think I'm a workaholic, but I point to my father and I say, no, he is. But I wanted to create systems in which, my father or I could check in on the restaurants without necessarily physically being in five places at once, and trying to make that possible for him, and for myself and for whoever else. I've used technology to try to make that happen.
Right. Well, I'd imagine your father started the first restaurant and organically grew, right? So he didn't have time to just take a look and review and automate everything. So you are doing it. And I heard that you added things like email, direct deposit, 401k programs, health insurance, and all those things. Very important. But he probably didn't have time before. So
I think the difference between him and me is he has the experience of building something from the ground up, from zero. He knows and has the confidence to build, and if it doesn't go well, to switch and to pivot and make things, to fix things. I joined the company without understanding or knowing through my body and feel what it means to build a company. And so the difference there manifests in the sense of he knows by feel. He knows by what's the word in English? Just intuition. He has that street smart kind of, he has that street smart, the intuition, and I call it the antenna. He knows. Versus me, I need metrics. I need data. I need to see tangibly in order to make decisions. And so, I think therein lies the difference in our operation structure or style, in the sense that he didn't need necessarily a more rigid structure in order to operate his business, because he could feel things. He had the intuition, versus me. And whoever comes after me needs metrics, needs numbers to know where to go to chart the course.
So you and your father are like yin and yang, like almost like you have a perfect pair to run the business.
I don't know if that's the case, but thank you for saying that.
I think so. And so then what does your day look like as the CEO of the company with 13 restaurants?
I would say that pre-COVID, my days looked like kind of like a firefighter, maybe, in the sense that I was putting out fires. I mean, I guess even now I'm putting out fires left and right. I'm trying to work towards creating a system where I am more proactive than reactive, but a lot of my job was to fix things, to problem solve, which is the best part of my job. I find it so interesting, even though if it can be kind of tiresome. I found my job to be very riveting in the sense of every day the problems were different, but also the same because I was just problem solving. But in terms of the different types of problems that I had, whether that it was, you know, trying to renegotiate our lease or coming up with a better menu structure or replying to customer suggestions or trying to think of a better social media approach or HR issues or figuring out structural license issues, things like that. It was just, the problems are all problems, and that's what makes the job the same every day. But
it's like you're living in a giant game, and you're very positive and, you know, for problem solving. I think the way you look at it, it's a challenge, and it's an opportunity to learn from. So yeah, that's great. I really like your attitude. So then what is the biggest challenge for you as the CEO of the restaurant group, which, by the way, operates such a diverse range of Japanese food concept, right? It's not like a Nobu or something like one concept, many branches. It's just each one of them is very different. So what's the biggest challenge?
I think from an operational standpoint, it's knowing where to standardize systems because it's not one size fits all, and not to say that the chains are one size fits all, but it's harder to create manuals. It's harder to standardize things when you have such a diverse portfolio. And that's definitely the biggest operational challenge. I think in terms of, if you're asking me as in my job, what is the biggest challenge? I would definitely, without a doubt, say family business structure is probably the hardest part of my job. In the sense that, it's a blessing to be able to be close to my family. But at the same time, it definitely complicates the company, in terms of operationally speaking and just from an emotional standpoint. I would say that some people might assume that family business, you know, you get a lot of, that it's easier, but actually I think it can be very, very difficult in many ways. And so I think working with family is probably the most difficult part of my job.
Right. Okay. So let's take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll discuss the latest trends in the New York City Japanese food culture and how Sakura is coping with the coronavirus crisis. So please stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Brooklyn Ball Factory, a Japanese eatery and coffee shop at 95 Montrose Avenue in East Williamsburg. Brooklyn Ball Factory uses the best ingredients to make Japanese comfort food, like their bento boxes featuring meatballs, grilled veggies, Japanese fried chicken, or pork shabu shabu. Plus, visit Brooklyn Ball Factory's sister restaurants, Momo Sushi Shack, Samurai Papa, Samurai Mama, Bozu, and Kitade Shokudo. Learn more at brooklynballfactory.com.
Welcome back. You are listening to Japanese. I'm your host, Akiko Atayama, and my guest today is Sakura Yagi, who is the Chief Operating Officer at the TIC Group, which operates 13 unique Japanese restaurants in New York City. So So Japanese food has become very popular lately all over the world. And what are the customer demographics at the TIC Group restaurants?
I would say that in recent years, it has definitely skewed towards young Asian patrons. We're especially in an area where NYU students are prevalent. And so as NYU students' body has changed to include a lot more international students, I think our patron demographic has changed a lot.
Interesting.
In that sense, though, I would say that we still have customers who have been dining with us for 30 years, who are not just locals, but also people who have moved and who have just been a loyal customer for all these years. And so I would say that those customers are our bread and butter.
Wow. It's amazing. Yeah. Well, that's the thing. That's the reflection of how you stay authentic and hasn't been diluted or anything. So that's really a clear indication how successful the company's concept is so far. So you are in a unique position to be able to capture the latest of Japanese food trend in New York City through your restaurants. And also as, you know, manager of the restaurant, you probably look into many different areas of the food industry. So what are the latest trends in Japanese food culture right now?
I think that people are becoming more aware of the different types of Japanese food there are. I think maybe 6 years ago, people didn't really know what omurice was. I would say that people are now expanding the meaning of Japanese food. There's definitely an interesting progress of what Japanese food means to people. I would say that in the 90s, it was about sushi, and sushi is still very popular, but I would say that pre-COVID, I think you would say omakase to anyone in New York, and people would instantly think that it's omakase sushi. And so I think Japanese terms have become very mainstream, even though it might be a little skewed. For example, omakase doesn't necessarily mean sushi, but I think most New Yorkers think that way. And in that sense, also, yoshoku, or like Western Japanese food, has become very, very trendy in terms of what kind of Japanese food there is. You can see it not just in New York, but I think, I have friends who are in Nashville who are talking about tamago sando or omurice, things a little bit more yoshoku focused.
Right. So can you maybe explain briefly, because a lot of listeners probably don't know what yoshoku is. So what is yoshoku?
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry, one second.
You're busy COO.
Sorry. Okay.
Can you maybe airplane the phone?
Sure.
I just did it too.
Okay, hold on. Okay, I think that should be okay. Sorry about that. So yoshoku is Yoshoku is Western Japanese food, in the sense that they are taking what is known as traditionally Western food, like sandwiches, but putting a Japanese spin to it. For example, like pasta, you have Napolitan pasta, which is made with ketchup, for example, and that's a very Japanese kind of food that a lot of Japanese kids grew up eating, but you wouldn't immediately think that it's Japanese. Or omurice is one of my favorites, but it's omelet with ketchup rice, and that's something that a lot of parents would make for their kids, and that's something that I also grew up eating and I personally love.
Me too. Yeah. Yeah, everybody should try eat it. And yoshoku should be something very comforting. And somehow it's usually, I mean, it's like very home cooking, but there are specialized restaurants, and it's simple but deep. And I think it's kind of appealing as ramen in a way, because it's so comforting.
Exactly. I think people are now seeing Japanese food not just as this high-end experience, but that there are elements to it which is comforting. I think, ramen, the trend of ramen, it really just brought out this idea that Japanese food can be like a comfort food. And I think that's where it's trending, in the sense of yoshoku too. It's something that I grew up reading as a kid, and it's, for me, ultimate comfort food. Kare also is a comfort food for me. For a lot of athletes too, katsukare, like pork katsu, cutlet with Japanese curry and rice. I mean, that's something that you eat before a big game. It's just this image of Japanese food not being this dainty, I don't know how else to explain it besides
right.
dainty.
I mean, it's kind of cutlet.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like on top of a rich, creamy curry, probably you get a lot of energy and you can start running right away. The thing is that, like you said, Japanese food tend to be still sushi or ramen, but there's so much. And great thing about your group is that they're totally different kinds of food that we normally don't know being existing if you're
exactly.
not in Japan. Yeah.
Exactly.
Right. So, all right. So that was yoshoku, and listeners, you really definitely should take a look at the TIC group's restaurants or menus. It's amazing. So you are Japanese American, grew up in New York, but your job is very focused on authentic Japanese culture. So you have a very unique vantage point of Japanese culture. So what do you think is the most wonderful thing about Japanese culture and Japanese food culture?
Unique thing. I think that, like we were just talking about, I think it's very wide ranging. You have very upscale that, you have the kaiseki, and to experience that kind of hospitality, that omotenashi, and to be able to have that kind of experience that's so authentically Japanese. But then you can go to this hole-in-the-wall, grungy, five-seat ramen shop where no one talks to each other and you just slurp and you, leave. That's also very authentically Japanese, and I think that range is so interesting in Japan and in Japanese food culture. And I feel very lucky to be able and privileged to have experienced that whole kind of range. Is interesting. Yeah.
Right. Okay. And so What are your plans in the short term and the long term? Because I heard you initially planned to stay in the company for only 5 years and you passed it. So what is your plan?
I think that that's a very interesting question to ask during COVID, only because, like everybody else, the future is so unknown. I think this is a time for the restaurant industry to really assess how it's been operating. And we also have to reassess what our business is like, how we can survive, and what our future holds. And it looks very different from what we thought it was going to be. But I think to reimagine, as Cuomo says, reimagine, pivot, all these things is what we're doing right now. And so I don't know. I don't know what the future holds. It's really hard to say. But I spend my days right now working at one of the restaurants where we consolidated a few of our brands into one location so that we can keep an eye on the brands and the operations much more closely to keep our restaurant operating. I think right now it's not about profitability, but about trying to create jobs and keeping our staff safe. And so my immediate goal is to attempt to try to get back on our feet. The restaurant industry has been pretty much decimated by this virus. So, you know, we're still standing, but I want to make sure that we continue standing, but on solid feet, not on wobbly feet. And so my job right now is to do that, to take care of this place, to take care of the restaurants that are open, and most importantly, take care of our staff that is manning these restaurants to make sure that we have a future.
Right. Yeah, after this, if you pass, get this through, you are invincible. There's nothing like this. go ahead.
I think that it's such a devastating time that we're in. And to acknowledge that it is devastating is important, but it can also be an opportunity to really sit, reflect, think about what is important. And I think that's what we're all trying to do. What is important, whether that's in our own personal lives or in work. And, I'm trying to make it a point to really assess what can we do? How can we, same thing as when I joined the company, how can we survive this as a company? And realistically speaking, how can we weather the storm? And I think it just is about one problem at a time. And there are days when it's really, really difficult to just focus on that one problem in front of you because you're thinking of all the other problems that are swirling in your mind. But if I can just figure out one problem, I can get to the next problem. And that's kind of been my mantra these few couple of weeks. And again, it goes back to community. I have local restaurant owner friends. We have one restaurant that's right next to us. That's a Vietnamese restaurant, Madame Vo. But, you know, just talking to fellow people and, you know, supporting each other. It goes back to what my father has been saying from the beginning in the sense of community is what moves us forward.
Right. Yeah, that's really important. And I will have to remember there's one thing. You solve it, and that's the only thing you can do, that you focus and you clear it. There's something else. I think you are almost like going to the gym. Your muscles are stronger by solving one thing, and next you're getting stronger. So it is hard, but I think after this, I think everybody's stronger and smarter.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, I think, you know, my heart goes out to everyone who's lost, you know, a loved one because of it. But at the same time, I do think that maybe it's also a time to just reflect on what our lives have been so far and how we want to shape what our future looks like. And that's, you know, I'm not immune to that either. You know, I'm reflecting on what I need to do. And my daughter's a year and a half, and you know, this, what the future holds, is just up in the air now. So if you think about it that way, then it lets you kind of imagine more and think more and think about the possibilities. I mean, it's a very, very interesting, scary, yet eye-opening time, I would say.
Right. Okay. So New York City is right now gradually and slowly reopening the restaurant. So which one is open and what is your strategy right now? I mean, like, listeners who wants to order something from there, which one is open?
Thank you. Yeah. So at the beginning of COVID, we closed all of our locations just out of abundance of caution. After a few weeks of being closed at all of our locations, I reopened up Korea, just to do some hospital donations to, our healthcare workers. And just kind of, I was inspired by another, East Village restaurant, 886, a Taiwanese restaurant who was doing the same thing. And, you know, it really gave me a sense of purpose. And it also, allowed me to keep the engine going so that when things restarted, we had, you know, a little bit of momentum, very small momentum, one location. But so Korea has been open, for the longest. But what we did was we combined our Korea shop, with our ramen shop. So now we're located in one location in Rairaiken. So you can order ramen and curry, as well as takoyaki, from our, one shop on 10th Street. We're also open.
That sounds very comforting. Like, oh, that's the thing.
Yes. It's like a one-stop comfort shop. Right next to us, we have Shabutatsu that's open, for dinner service, alfresco, dining on Ishiyaki, like hot stone grilling. That's kind of what we're doing right now, as well as bibimbap. That's open for Shabutatsu. And we recently reopened High Collar, our Yoshoku place that does great omurice. And we relocated that spot onto our 9th Street place. So everyone's finding a new home. But High Collar, Sake Bar Decibel, Sobaya, and Hasaki are open for outdoor dining and takeout on 9th Street. So 9th Street is becoming very niyaka. It's very lively. And also on 10th Street, too. We're kind of holding down the fort. So, yeah, I think East Village is opening up, and it's been not just our locations, but I know you had Arena on your program. Yoshida, their locations are open, some of them. And on St. Mark's Place, I know, you know, some of the Taiwanese places, the other Asian places are open. So East Village is definitely trying to get back on its feet, and, you know, we're open for business, so people should come by.
Right. Great. So where can we check all the updates about your restaurants?
The best thing is actually to either follow each of our restaurants' Instagram or self-plug right here, but you can also follow all of the most recent updates by following my personal Instagram handle, where I post everything about our restaurant group. I find it the easiest. So my handle is at Sakura_Yagi. That's where I post everything about our restaurant. So
cool.
Please follow
and
me
also,
there.
And also, the new beautiful website that you built, I believe, is www.tic-nyc.com. TIC-NYC.com, right? So,
right.
And
yes.
You see all the beautiful list of restaurants. So,
thank you.
Okay. Yeah, so, okay, so thank you for joining us today in your super busy schedule. And
thank you so much.
Yeah, keep me posted and I'll come back again and we'll talk about more.
Yes, yes, please come and visit. Have a bowl of ramen or curry on me and we'll weather this storm together.
Ah, yes, sure, definitely. Yeah, yeah. But seriously, I think I learned so much from your good spirit. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on your show. It was a really great time.
Great. Our listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japaneats@heritageradionetwork.org or at kikuatayama.com. Japaneats is always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. And engineer is Matt Patterson. And thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Japaneats is powered by Simplecast. Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a non-profit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thank you for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.